Joining me in the Catalyst studio today is Monica Angel, who is involved with multiple organizations that I haven't quite worked out exactly yet. So I'm going to let her share that information with you.
Thank you for having me. So I am the founder and executive director of Cure Kids Cancer Now. We fund pediatric brain cancer research. I am also the CEO of Save the Kids Foundation, who's presenting Disrupt the Bay next week, November 7th. And I also serve as the director of community affairs for Hope for ATRT, which is a particular kind of brain cancer that occurs in children.
Thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. So Disrupt the Bay is coming up quickly. You've been working hard to get this ready. Can you talk a little bit about Disrupt the Bay?
Yes, absolutely. We're very excited about Disrupt the Bay. So it has a couple of different parts to the day. The most important part that I always like to mention is that all of the ticket sales and proceeds are going to fund pediatric cancer research, namely neuroblastoma and ATRT brain cancer. But the day itself has a few different parts. So the first part is we have 10 innovative tech startups from Tampa Bay who are going to be presenting their ideas. So we're really excited about that. We're also going to have a roundtable panel of providers from Tampa, including Cancer Treatment Centers of America, Tampa General Hospital, BayCare. They will be talking about the innovative tech that they have experienced in their work lives and also what they'd kind of like to see coming forward. After that, we'll have a keynote speaker, an author by the name of Jay Samet. He wrote a book called Disrupt You. He's also kind of a serial innovator and disruptor and entrepreneur.
And this is a really interesting model for a fundraiser, right? It's not, you know, your typical ball or, and you're actually putting on a business conference around a theme. So how did that come into your head or how did that?
Absolutely. So I think hopefully it's the first of many, but what we're trying to do is think outside the box by way of fundraising for childhood cancer research. It's really challenging. There are so many great organizations out there. And so we don't want to duplicate efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all these other organizations and they are having fashion shows and fishing tournaments and galas, of course, and silent auctions and all these things. And I go to them and I enjoy them. But oftentimes what happens is it's the same crowd over and over again. It's the crowd that already cares about childhood cancer. It's the crowd that's already going to support it. What we'd like to do is educate people who don't already support it and let them know why they should. And so what we figured was we would host events starting with Disrupt the Bay that get people in the room because of something they're interested in, because of something they want to do. And so I'll be taking about 15 minutes out of a 7-hour program to talk about childhood cancer. And like I said, the ticket sales and the sponsorships also go to fund the research. But really, we're trying to meet people where they are and provide them something that they want to do no matter what, and then also use it as an opportunity to educate people about childhood cancers.
That's really smart. I mean, that innovation is born out of a need because there are so many different groups competing for those same dollars. So you found a way to, you know, competition in a sense drove you to this unique innovation. Can you talk about having done this for a couple of years, how that landscape feels to you?
So it's really interesting. I think that there are some organizations out there who are certainly wildly competitive, right? And within the childhood cancer world, that exists too, where we are really competing for the same dollars. But then there's groups like ours who thrive on collaboration. And some of us really try to work together and build each other up and help each other. Oh, that printer will help you and give you a good deal, or that guy can help you with the website, or here's a researcher that you should talk to. They don't necessarily work on the cancer I work on, but this is something that might be interesting to you. So there's some of us who really do thrive on working together. And I've been lucky enough to work with a bunch of those. Two of them are being funded or have been chosen as the beneficiaries of the Disrupt the Bay conference. BeatNB, which, like I said, funds neuroblastoma, and Hope for ATRT, which funds ATRT brain cancer research.
Obviously, a lot of these organizations come out of personal experience. Mm-hmm. Is that because people have that level of emotion involved? You know, have you been able to put your finger on why some collaborate and some don't?
I think that there's truth to that for sure. So oftentimes a childhood cancer foundation is going to be started because of a personal connection. So for example, ours, we started Cure Kids Cancer Now after the death of our daughter, Emmy Grace, who died when she was 5 months old because of treatment for ATRT brain cancer. We started a foundation because we wanted to honor her memory and her fight, and also because we wanted to make sure that it didn't continue to happen to other families. But because of that, we feel like this is part of her legacy and we want that to continue. And that's not unique. That happens with plenty of other families. And the other foundations that I was referring to earlier were largely started in the same way to honor a particular child. And over time, sometimes these foundations will grow and it can be really hard to think of the legacy that you've created for your child being taken away and changing into something different. So even though many of us partner together, oftentimes we don't want to lose that piece that connects it directly to our own child.
And so to some extent, you know, ideally growth and more effectiveness is the theoretical goal, but sometimes not the operational reality because of that.
Sure. That's why I think collaborating with others also really works. So for example, Cure Kids Cancer Now and Hope for ATRT is funding the same project. So we're writing checks to the same group, we're writing checks to the same researcher, we're doing the same thing, but we've maintained our individuality in order to maintain that legacy for our own children.
You know, you're at the front lines with the collaboration, with the competition, and the multitude of folks that are in this space for whatever reason. And as you've been navigating this space for the last couple of years, what are some of the common misconceptions about the space?
Sure. So I'd say the biggest one is that childhood cancer is a solved problem. Oftentimes we see these commercials on TV, right? And they show you these beautiful bald babies. Mm-hmm. And then they show Jennifer Aniston walking in with flowers and everybody's smiling and happy and everything's great. What they're not showing you is the child who is covered in welts because of results of chemotherapy throwing up. They're not showing you the parents who are wiping down their kids in the middle of the night. They're not showing you the painful truths behind some of this. They're not showing you the pictures like I have of my daughter, where she was connected to so many machines, I couldn't hold her anymore. And she was only 3 months old at the time. So one of the biggest problems that we have, or one of the biggest misconceptions that we are trying to help clarify, is that childhood cancer is a solved problem. The second biggest one is that it's one big thing. Childhood cancer is not one big disease. We do not talk about adult cancers the same way that we talk about kids' cancers. So for example, if we make a breakthrough in breast cancer research, we don't congratulate prostate cancer victims or patients because they're two completely separate things. Even within breast cancer, you're going to have different kinds of diagnoses. The same is true for childhood cancers. So when we make an amazing breakthrough for lymphoma or leukemia, both of which have higher survival rates as a direct result of higher levels of funding that they've received over the past years, we don't then say, oh, but now brain cancer is a survivable disease. And so unfortunately, because we've lumped childhood cancer together as if it's one big thing, sometimes those survival numbers and rates get a little bit skewed when we're looking at it that way.
You made a comment in there that the leukemia was one of the more curable ones because of the amount of money that's been put in. So that must be an additional layer of pressure, knowing that the actual success of raising the money, as demonstrated historically, does matter in how quickly results are reached.
Oh, absolutely. So one thing for us is I'm always really motivated by leukemia. And that's not to say that all children who get this diagnosis now are doing well. There are still children who are dying from that, and that's unacceptable. But when we look back to my childhood, for example, if a child was diagnosed with leukemia at that time, it was a death sentence. Today, it does not have to be true. Many more of those children are surviving. My goal is that by the time my almost five-year-old is my age, she can say the same thing about ATRT. She can say, yes, back in 2016, my sister died of ATRT, and somebody looks at her and says, but nobody dies of ATRT anymore. That's kind of our goal. So because we know that it works, and we've seen it work in adult cancers, we've seen it work in some childhood cancers and many other diseases. Look at AIDS research. We've seen the survival rates increase as a direct correlation to the funding. And so it can be a little bit frustrating in that way to think that we are allowing children to die because we're not funding it better. I mean, right now we've got 5 American children dying each and every day from cancer and its related treatments, but we're saying it's so rare we don't need to fund it better. So these things don't really line up well. The better part of that is that I really believe that there is a brilliant idea sitting in a notebook somewhere that just needs to be funded. I think we've got way too many people that are far too brilliant to think that no one has an idea that's going to solve this particular problem. What they don't have is the money. And so that's where we step in, and we're trying to help to facilitate that funding at a faster rate.
And some of this work, you know, speaking of money, has led you down roads of, you know, administrative inefficiencies. Before, we were talking about folks who had to stay in the hospital and use those resources and those funds because of insurance anomalies that they couldn't get a very simple treatment at home, so they had to stay in the hospital.
Absolutely. So one of our favorite projects that we do every year, we do as in honor of our daughter Emmy Grace's birthday. So this coming December, we will be honoring what should be her 4th birthday, had cancer and its treatments not killed her. But what we do is we go to the hospital and we find that there are children who, and this isn't unique to childhood cancer, but there are children who have been medically cleared to go home. Their doctors think they're safe enough to go home. But unfortunately, their insurance has denied that coverage for the necessary medicine and supplies at home. So what we do is right before Christmas, because Emmy's birthday was right before Christmas, we go and we find out if there are any childhood cancer patients that are in that category where they're safe enough to go home, they're well enough to go home, but either they're underinsured or uninsured. And so are kind of in a situation where now the parents are expected to pay for it, or sometimes the hospital foundations will step in, because thankfully we've got great hospitals in our area who will do that. But what we do is we step in and we say, go home. And so we pay for their meds to go home. And one of the things that we really try to do with Cure Kids Cancer Now is provide time which as we know is the most limited resource any of us have. So if we can provide time by funding research that keeps the kids alive, that's ideal. But in the short term, we're providing time by giving a family a Christmas at home where they're not having to worry about taking out a second job so that they can pay for the meds to get their kids at home for Christmas, or time at home where they're not having to trek back and forth to the hospital because they've got some kids at home and some kids in the hospital. So we're really just trying to provide time as best we can.
And obviously the circumstances that led you down this road are sad, but it also is heartening to know that you're bringing this energy and this innovation to the space, and we'll be excited to watch you continue to do what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. I mean, Emmy died when she was 5 months old, and it's important for me to say that as often as possible because she was 3 months old and she was perfect and she was beautiful and she was healthy. And she also then had a giant brain tumor growing on her brainstem. And so we took her to the hospital and she had a tumor resection surgery, which she wasn't supposed to survive. And she did. And then she underwent 3 additional surgeries after that, another brain surgery. She did all of these things and she kept surviving because children are resilient. And she also was given the best possible care because that was important to us. And we were in a position where we were able to provide that for her. And we were naive enough to think that because we could get her the best possible specialist, she would be okay. Because at that time, we thought that in this country, if you got them to the best specialist, that would be it. Of course, they would be okay. And what we found was even the best possible specialists are using really old, outdated treatments. So by way of example, Emmy Grace was given 5 different chemotherapy drugs. Each of them was approved prior to my birth. So the most recent drug she was given was approved in 1983. All of them were designed and approved for use in adults, some for use in adult testicular cancer in the 50s and in the 60s. And that's what we were giving to a baby girl with brain cancer in 2016. All we had done was we'd watered it down and dosed it down. And still, it was so wildly toxic for her young body that within 2 months, she went into multi-organ failure and septic shock. And so she didn't die from her brain tumor. She didn't die from cancer. She died from the treatment that she was given for the cancer. I mean, for those of us who are parents, we know you can't even give them an adult Tylenol when they're little. We reformulate everything for babies. But for some reason, we have stuck with the kind of status quo of giving them these hand-me-down adult treatments, even though their organs are still developing, their bodies metabolize them differently, they're wildly toxic for these kids, but we're throwing it all at them. And we're doing that because unfortunately, we don't have a better option. These doctors are working so hard trying to treat these kids really well, but the tools in their toolbox aren't good enough. And so we're trying to fund them so that they have better tools and so that these children will survive.
Well, as we go down that road, then assuming the funding comes in, then where does it go?
So for us in particular, our goal is to fund ATRT research first and additional brain tumors. Unfortunately, when a child is first diagnosed with a brain tumor, you don't necessarily know what the diagnosis is. So we're working with CBTTC, which is the Child Brain Tissue Tumor Consortium. And what they're doing is essentially setting up a giant biorepository, which is essentially a big cooler of tumor tissues. They keep them alive, they maintain them, they study them, they do the genomic studies on them, and then they provide them to other researchers. So part of what makes ATRT so hard to research is that A, it only is occurring in about 100 kids each and every year. That incidence rate is rising, but that's currently where we are, about 100 kids a year. So if you think about those 100 kids being spread out all across the country, some of those tumors are going to, you know, a researcher in California, some in Michigan, some in Florida, some in New York, but none of those researchers have enough of them, right? So we need more tumors in one place so that they can develop a proper hypothesis and start doing trials on them. So what CBTTC is doing is compiling all of them together and then providing them free of charge to any researcher who wants access to them. And all they're asking in return is share what you find so that we don't have researchers in different parts of the country and really in different parts of the world duplicating efforts. Because as we mentioned earlier, it's a limited purse that we're dealing with.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's kind of the biggest one that we're funding right now because it can provide the largest effect on the most amount of researchers. Outside of that, we can then fund particular projects as they come along. And we do a lot of legislative work, which is really important to us because no matter how many fundraisers I have, I can throw Disrupt the Bay 80 times over and we are not going to have a $5.6 billion budget to work with. So I do my best to convince Congress to encourage the NCI to redistribute some of the funds that they're already getting and redistribute them to some of the deadlier forms of kids' cancers. Instead of money following incidence rate, I would like money to follow death rates. And so when we've got kids that are dying each and every day, and we've got diagnoses that still have a 0% chance of survival, a 1% chance of survival, a 10% chance of survival, we need to fund those at a higher degree. We need to give those a higher priority and say, this is unacceptable. Kids should not be dying in this country based on lack of funding.
And you've actually gone yourself up to do this work in DC. And how have we found that process?
So it's really interesting. Over the past couple of years, I would say it's different. It's changed over the past few years. In the first year, which was 2016, there was a lot of education that we had to do while we were there and talking about childhood cancer. Here's the truth behind it. Here's the numbers, these kinds of things. Over the years, it's been very exciting to see that we don't have to do that as much because people are paying attention and they are seeing how many kids in their district are dying, how many kids are being diagnosed, what are the real effects of childhood cancers? What does survivorship even look like? If we're going to talk about the ones that are lucky enough to survive, what does that look like? And so as our legislators have started to pay attention, they have started to make that shift. And even this year, President Trump, in his State of the Union address, promised $50 million towards a childhood cancer data initiative. So that's really exciting. Of course, that's a drop in the bucket for what we actually need. So we'd like to see that funded at a higher level, but it's a good start.
All right. And so with the lobbying and the three nonprofits and the Disrupt event, that's all, right? Nothing else? No other awards?
Oh, there's always something else. So in the spring, we are going to be hosting our first annual Emmy Awards, E-M-M-I. In our work, we have found that there are some really spectacular organizations here in Tampa, and better yet, there's really great people in the Bay Area. And so what we're doing is we're going to start collecting submissions for nominations for people who you just think are awesome. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's because they're the volunteer who shows up for absolutely everything. Maybe it's because they run an organization that nobody knows about but does amazing work, these kinds of things. So we're going to open submissions to anyone in the Tampa Bay area. We're really excited to start reading through some of those. We'll narrow it down to 10, and we'll be hosting a luncheon on the first Friday of March at Pomacea, where we'll invite the top 10 to come and kind of pitch what it is that they support and why. And we'll sell tickets to that event, and all those in the room will have the opportunity to vote. And the one who receives the most votes will also receive a grant for the foundation of their choice.
Another innovative and cool idea.
Yeah. Listen, there's too many good people to not honor them.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. I love the energy. I love the innovation. I can feel the power, and it's refreshing and wonderful, and don't stop.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll keep going.